This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome, Place to Be Nation pop listeners, to the hard traveling fanboys. This is it's a pretty difficult edition. We've I'm Greg Phillips, of course, and with me as always is Nick Duke. And ladies and gentlemen, we've got some sad news to report. Our friend, Ho-Ho Loon, has been eliminated from the WWE Cruiserweight Classic.
I mean, this is not... I mean, this isn't part of the show, folks. I mean, this is real life. And, you know, we hate to be the ones to have to bring you this news if you haven't heard already. The whole hopes of a nation. They just died.
They've been dashed, and you know, we will be at some point airing the Ho-Ho Loon tribute show, and we hope you tune into that. Honestly, it's hard to even go on, but you know, as we mentioned last week, we're both in the entertainment business, and in the entertainment business, quite frankly, the show must go on.
Indeed, and the show must go on.
You know, it's unfortunate that the circumstances are what they are. It's unfortunate that a selfish,
no good bastard,
rat, bastard, turd in the punch bowl of life,
a Richard, if you will,
a Richard known as the Noam Dar, decided to ruin everything. But nevertheless, we will carry on, and we would like to dedicate this edition of Countdown to the memory of our friend Ho-Ho Loon's 2016 WWE Cruiserweight Classic tournament run. Farewell, Ho-Ho, we barely knew thee.
That's right. And this season, when we're listening to Vern Lundquist, and every time we hear a chortle, Ho-Ho Loon will be with us, Greg. Wherever Vern is mispronouncing a name, Ho-Ho Loon will be there. Whenever Whispering Bill Anderson is mentioned, Ho-Ho Loon will be there.
Whenever they're reminiscing about the on-field exploits of D'Andrew White, Ho-Ho Loon will be there. But with all that out of the way, we do have to carry on with the show. And ladies and gentlemen, this edition of Countdown is going to be looking at a topic that we've never done before: our top five Marvel Comics crossover events. Could be X-Men crossovers, Spider-Man crossovers, Marvel Universe as a whole crossovers. We got a lot of stuff in here, folks. And to help us do this, we went to none other than the Marvel Comics expert himself, backed by popular demand, the ravishing Russian, Tim Capel. I have no idea if he's of Russian descent, but I thought I just wanted to call him that.
Absolutely. He's back, and going to hit us up with some of his encyclopedic Marvel knowledge, and I'm sure a lot of his list will focus heavily on the X-Men.
That's correct. Indeed. But before we get there, we have other elements to our show, as you all know, all you people out there in Larry Land, all you Larry Zbysko fans out there. we have got a little thing that we like to call what you're reading and what you're watching. However, I haven't been reading anything. I have not read anything this past week, and there is nothing comic book related on other than Fear the Walking Dead, which I have not watched and am far behind on. So I'm going to defer to Nick again this week. Nick, what you reading and what you watching?
Well, I'm not watching anything, much like yourself. I haven't even seen a single episode of Fear the Walking Dead this season. I hope to catch up at some point, but it's just another thing on my long list of shows I need to catch up on. I got to finish Supergirl Season 1, I got to finish Daredevil Season 2, and I got to start Fear the Walking Dead Season 2. So.
I take it back. I watched 2 episodes of Daredevil Season 2 this past week, now that I think about it.
Well, let's just share our thoughts on Daredevil for whenever we both finally finish
kick
the season.
Kick that can down the road.
Yeah, kick the can down the road, because I don't want to, you know, I haven't watched much of it. And quite frankly, I don't want any spoilers.
You didn't buy the attraction.
Absolutely. So let's jump over, I guess, to my reading, and should I start with top or bottom this week, Greg?
Well, as usual, I think you start at your number 3 and work your way to 1 and then go to the worst.
Fair enough. With that being said, I'm going to start at number 3. I've got Batman number 5. I thought this was the best issue of the Batman solo title thus far. It plays off, or it wraps up the Gotham storyline in a very satisfactory fashion. It also sets up some intriguing events that should be playing out in the Batman title down the road. And I thought it also gave pretty much every character in the book a standout moment, including one of my favorite Alfred moments in recent memory that I can't wait for you to read. And once again, David Finch is just killing it on art. Tom King's doing an excellent job scripting these plots and writing this dialogue. Loved, loved, loved Batman number 5. At number 2, no shock to anyone, I've got Aquaman number 5.
Do you have Aquaman or do you have Aquaman?
Actually, this week it's just Aquaman.
Oh, okay, good.
Strangely enough, yes. Anyway, loved this book once again. It continues the trend or the story that we've seen of Mira and Arthur facing off against the U.S. government and trying their best to resist peacefully. But in this issue, they're finally pushed a little bit too far, and they have to throw down with an army unit. And it's just a really, really well-done book. Mira continues to be, I think, the breakout character of this title. Very much looking forward to, you know, her being what she seems to be the primary focus of a storyline coming up in November based on the solicits that came out a couple days ago, or today, exactly. You know, very much enjoying this title. Ready for you to get caught up on it so we can talk more in depth. And then finally, at number 1, I've got what I think is the best book of Rebirth going. I've got Green Arrow number 5. This kind of puts a pin for now in the Ninth Circle storyline in a highly satisfactory fashion. Kind of gives you some answers about what exactly Amiko's allegiance and what her deal is and what it has been. And it also sets the stage for what I think is a very interesting next story arc that sees Oliver Queen back on the island that created him. So, very much looking forward to seeing where this book goes from here. Green Arrow just continues to impress every time an issue comes out. It was pretty easily my number 1 book of the week. My bottom book of the week, however, and this might surprise you a little bit. My bottom book of the week, Greg, I'm going with Suicide Squad number 1. Now, you might remember when last we discussed the old Suicide Squad, I was complaining because the Rebirth title did not have art from Jim Lee. I'm going to say something somewhat controversial probably here.
You better not say it, Nick. You better not say what I'm worried you're going to say.
We had Jim Lee art here. It was not up to Jim Lee standards, in my opinion. I thought the interiors on this book looked rushed and unpolished. I thought the writing was not very good, honestly. To be honest, I think the art in the backup from Jason Fabok was actually better than the main story art from Jim Lee this week. The writing on that story, the backup is a Deadshot, backup, was very good. The backup to this issue was quite good. The main story, I thought, was pretty terrible. I didn't think any of the characters were written well. I thought the art had a choppy feeling to it. This book has officially, after only, you know, a rebirth and a number one, found its way quickly off of my pull list, given the impressive quality of Rebirth as a whole thus far.
You want it to take the same path that Bobby Roode wants all the t-shirt and cargo short-wearing members of the NXT Zone to do. He wants them to get out. They're done. So you're telling Suicide Squad to get out. It's done, essentially.
I am indeed telling it that. And then I'll jump over for a few just quick hits real quick. Like, speaking of books that are now probably off my pull list, I can't decide if I'm giving Justice League another issue to wrap up the cliffhanger they introduce here, but I really did not enjoy this issue of Justice League. I think Brian Hitch continues to struggle with the dialogue especially, and I thought this was the worst looking issue of Justice League that Tony Daniel has drawn thus far. Didn't do much for me in any respect, really. I might give it one more issue, but this one is pretty quickly going to be off my pull list. You know, within a couple of weeks, I'm fairly sure. I mean, and that sucks. I want a Justice League title to be good. I want to follow a Justice League title because I feel like the Justice League title should be very important to the overall, you know, central plot of Rebirth. But I just can't continue to justify spending $6 a month on this title when the quality hasn't been there. So this is another one that's going to be off my pull list very soon. Supergirl Rebirth number one. This one I would classify much in the same vein that I classified Hellblazer a couple weeks ago, and the same term as you used to describe Hellblazer. Perfectly fine comic, but given the quality of Rebirth thus far, perfectly fine comics don't have a place on my pull list. Nothing overly bad about it, just not going to be one I'm continuing in the future. Batgirl and the Birds of Prey number one. I continue to love the way this book is written. I think all three of the co-leads are written very, very well. There are some weird moments in the art, particularly in the facial expressions, that seem kind of off and a little too cartoonish for the story the book is telling. But the writing has sold me on this one, and I'm probably going to let it take the place of one of those two titles I just mentioned on my pull list going forward. Superman number five. This kind of puts a pin in the Eradicator storyline. Has some really cool moments, especially for Lois and John. I'm very intrigued to get your take once you have a chance to read it and see, and once you see what they do with the Eradicator here. Very much enjoyed this one. Patrick Gleason continues to wow on art, although I am ready for, I believe it's Ivan Reis is supposed to be cycling on pretty soon, right?
Yep.
I am very much looking forward to that, even though I've enjoyed Gleason's run. So another solid issue of Superman, in my opinion. Finally, what I think is, at long last, what I would call a really good issue of Green Lanterns. Green Lanterns hasn't been bad by any stretch of the imagination, but it started to slide towards the bottom of my pull list, but I thought this was the best issue yet. Really, really enjoyed particularly Jessica and the way she was written in this one. Just an entertaining ride of a book. Looks like they're getting ready to wrap up this initial Rage Seed storyline, but very intrigued to see how they deal with the emotional fallout of what happens to Jessica in this issue. So Green Lanterns number five was one that I very, very much enjoyed.
You've sufficiently piqued my interest by saying happens to Jessica, because I wonder if she's going through some hard times, if you will.
It's hard times when
don't spoil it.
When a working woman can't make her wages.
That's right. That's exactly right.
But, so those are the books I read this week.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Well, hopefully, ladies and gentlemen, assuming that my state-funded paycheck comes through this week from my job that I have in the real world, I will be able to collect my last month's worth of comics. And then, hopefully, at some point...
It'll only take him 3 months to read them.
Future, start reading them. And that'll be fun. That'll be great. But in the meantime, we're going to get to our next and our final segment before the break, the Rundown. Everybody's favorite segment. By everybody's, I mean probably nobody's. But we do it, and we enjoy it. And this is where we run down different news topics and items that we feel like discussing from the world of comic books. And we are going to start off in the realm of animation, actually, because a pretty cool announcement came out recently, backed by a couple of by a teaser and then a full-length trailer that just dropped recently. And that is a Batman 66 animated feature called Batman Return of the Caped Crusaders. And this is going to feature Adam West and Burt Ward reprising their roles as the Caped Crusaders, Batman and Robin the Boy Wonder.
And also Julie Newmar returning to be the voice of Catwoman.
Yes, returning as Catwoman. This caught me off guard, didn't know anything about it, and I am very excited about it. I think it's going to be really cool, or cool, if you will. The teaser was hilarious, and the trailer was really funny, too. Particularly the line at the end of the trailer, folks. I don't want to spoil it, but watch the trailer. It's got a great, great ending to it. And I'm excited about this. I think this is going to be fun. I always love me some Adam West pretty much in anything, particularly since he's incapable of not sounding like Mayor West to me now when I hear him. So,
yes, I'm pretty sure that Mayor West is just an extension of his real personality, or at least I like to imagine
it
that way.
I like to imagine it that way, too.
But I continue to love the late career resurgence of Adam West. That's such a great thing for that guy, and I'm all on board for this. I know a lot of people turn up their nose at the old Batman 66, but I as a separate incarnation, I'm completely fine with it. I'm looking forward to this. Good for Adam West and Burt Ward, man. Good for those guys getting their name back out there and making a little more coin off their legacy. So they've got me pre-sold. I can't wait for this, and I'm sure we will be bringing you our thoughts once we finally get to see the full-length movie.
And probably one of the things I'm looking forward to most is who they get to mimic Burgess Meredith as the Penguin.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by that.
As an amateur impressionist and voice guy, that's always been kind of one of the I guess dream gigs is a chance to do that role, because it's such an iconic role and such a iconic voice portrayal of Cobblepot.
I think it's going to be tougher, honestly, to cast the Gorshin sound alike, because that one was so distinctive, you know. Whereas if you can do the wah wah with the Penguin, you've pretty much got half the role down. But that Gorshin thing is like still. You know, you and I rewatched the Batman 66 theatrical movie when you were here last.
That is correct. And,
we were both just, I think, had forgotten how good Frank Gorshin was in that particular film and on that show. So, but I do know from listening to Hollywood Babylon, a podcast that Kevin Smith does with one Ralph Garman, that they are indeed looking for people to do impersonations of the old actors, because apparently Garman actually went in and read for the Cesar Romero Joker doing his Romero impression. So good to hear that's the approach they're taking with
it. And I don't know if you heard this, Nick. I was listening to a podcast the other day as well. They were actually talking about this movie. You know, they got Newmar and West and Ward back and all that, which is the main focus of everybody for obvious reasons. But not getting as much attention as the rest of the cast, they actually cast Jim Ross as Colonel Schmidlap. So, Commodore Schmidlap, rather.
I wonder what that would sound like.
I don't remember any of Commodore Schmidlap's lines, so I can't do it.
Oh, I got caught up in my Dickens, huh? Oh, Pip Pip.
Oh, Pip Pip, that's right. Pip Pip, you son of a bitch! For God's sake, what's that even mean? Pip Pip. Stupid asses. Give me my money.
Now, I wonder if Terry Funk were going to play a Batman 66 villain, who he might play.
Oh, gosh. Oh, he... There's only one option, isn't there? I mean...
I think so. I think we know.
He'd have to be Egghead, of course.
Of course.
Listen here. This is an egg-squisite plan, you egg-sucking dog. You son of a bitch. Me and my brother Dory. Dory Egg.
Oh, and then of course we would have old Jim Barnett as Crazy Quilt.
Was Crazy Quilt on Batman 66?
He was in the Batman 66 comic, so I'm going to count it as close enough.
never mind. I'll make that Jim Barnett joke off air.
Wait a minute! No!
I can't.
Now you You got to go for it. Come on.
Say, if he was going to play anybody on Batman 66, I would think that Jim Barnett would play Liberace's character from Batman 66.
But women loved him.
That's true. Mama,
in any event,
deceased ham sandwich.
In any event, I think to sum it up, yeah, we're pumped for this and look forward to bringing you our thoughts whenever the movie finally comes out.
That's correct. And my boy, and from there we move on to a much more comic book related story, which would be addressing something we had issues with a few weeks ago. And that is the name of Riri Williams once she is in the Iron Man suit, as many of you should know. Riri Williams is a young woman.
Which is tough to say.
It is a young woman who is going to be playing, or not playing, but she's going to inherit the Iron Man, or Iron Man, if you will, armor of Tony Stark and be wearing it around. And the title of the book is still going to be Iron Man, presumably with some adjective in front of it. But
the title is still The Invincible Iron Man.
Invincible Iron Man. And we were wondering, how can she be Iron Man when she is indeed a woman? And identifies
as such,
or a girl even. Well, they've solved that, because Marvel has made it known that she is going to be known as Iron Heart, which sounds like a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie from 1991, but it is not. That was Lionheart, and you should go watch it because it's awesome. But anyway, she'll be known as Iron...
Or what about that that movie where Sean Connery voiced a dragon?
Dragonheart. Yes.
Yeah, I like that.
That's a good one, too. Or what about Iron Eagle, where Louis Gossett Jr. and who was it? Robert Downey Jr., was it?
Or what about the Elvis Presley song, Wooden Heart?
What about the Dwight Yoakam song, Missing Heart? Let's just do this the rest of the show. Anyway, so Riri Williams is going to be known as Iron Heart. And yes, her name is almost as difficult to say as it is for Nick to say Telltale Games.
I knew that was coming, by the way. I was like, when we were making comments about how it was difficult to say, I was like, let's see, how long is it going to take Greg to work around to the Telltale Games thing?
Yep. Hey, you had it that time. Anyway, Nick, your thoughts on this, on Riri and her tenure as the Ironheart?
It's not a bad name, honestly. I wish they were just calling the book The Invincible Ironheart instead of The Invincible Iron Man, since she's not actually going to be Iron Man, and since Iron Man apparently isn't going to be in the book at all.
Or invincible.
In terms of a physical presence. So, you know, it's fine. It's a fine name. The character has actually been set up very well thus far in the current Invincible Iron Man series. So while I'm probably not going to pull this one just because of, you know, the amount of space that Rebirth is continuing to take up on my pull list, I am on board for this and we'll probably catch it in trade. I'm willing to give Bendis a shot at just about anything. So, looking forward to it. Like the name, just wish they would retitle the actual book.
I would agree with that. It's a good name. It's a fine name, and hopefully it will be successful for Marvel and get this new character established and out there, and another good new addition to the Marvel Universe. No problems there. Well, let's wrap up the rundown this week with one last item partner, and that one would be the
first down 10,
the announcement by Robert Kirkman that Invincible, as of issue number 144, will be coming to an end. This is a title that Kirkman created 144 issues ago, and that's a lot of issues. That's a lot of time investment. That's, you're looking at over a decade now, I believe over a decade. Yeah, over a decade of this story, this character, this universe that he created, the Invincible Universe, and it's finally coming to an end. Now, full disclosure, neither Nick nor I have ever read an issue of Invincible.
Not a single one.
Don't know anything about it, except that he's a superhero.
Nope. And he wears blue and yellow.
That's right. And it's...
It looks a little like Booster Gold sometimes.
Right. And it's acclaimed. But what we wanted to talk about more than so than Invincible Ending is what it represents. Because this is 144 issues is not something you see anymore from creators and their characters. And it represents, to me, the advantage of a creator-owned concept and a creator-owned universe, because as we've talked about before, Batman's never going to have an ending, really. Sure, you can write an ending, but the month after you leave, some new guy's going to come along and undo it and write their own thing. And that's the nature of the beast with corporate comics. With creator-owned comics, it's much more, I suppose, literary in terms of a beginning, a middle, and an end. And you as the creator get to dictate when your story ends and how it ends. And I think
if you want it to end, I mean, there is
right.
There's always the possibility that Kirkman could change his mind later and, you know, decide that somebody else can write this character or whatever. But he gets to dictate the way the story wraps up. And I think that's a great thing. And I think it should be celebrated, the fact that he's written the character for so long. I mean, the only other comparable run I can think of in any superhero comics, whether it be Big Two or creator owned, would be Brian Michael Bendis on Ultimate Spider-Man, which the argument could be made that's a run that started in 2001 that is still going to this day, because you can draw the direct lineage from Ultimate Spider-Man number one to the current adjectiveless Spider-Man series that he's still writing. But, you know, a massive accomplishment from Kirkman. And even though I don't know anything about Invincible, I certainly applaud the idea that, much like Starman in the 90s, he's going to be allowed to retire this character and to tell the story and give it closure in his way.
Exactly. I think that, and that's something that's really cool. And hopefully they'll be putting out some pretty cool omnibus collections wrapping up the entire run. And maybe if any enterprising individuals out there want to float a copy of one of these trade volumes to the hard-traveling fanboys, we would certainly be willing to take a look at it for our Long Book Hunters feature and give our thoughts on it.
Absolutely.
Well, with that, that's going to bring an end to an abbreviated rundown this week. Not a whole lot going on, honestly, in the world of comics right now, news-wise, that we haven't already covered anyway, so... we're going to put an end to the rundown, and we're going to go ahead and take a break here. And when we come back on the other side, we're going to hit you up with the man himself, the man of the hour, the tower of power, too sweet to be sour. He eats T-bone steaks, he lifts barbell plates, sweeter than a German chocolate cake. Tim Capel will be here to give his thoughts, along with ours, on the top five Marvel crossover events. Don't you dare go away. Listen out for that spectacular Kevin Kelly Show theme song from the commercials. Coming your way right now.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation is JT Rizzuto here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast, as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners, as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows are available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
In the luxurious studios of the hard-traveling fanboys in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I am Greg Phillips. With me, of course, as before the break, is still Nick Duke. However, we are joined this week by a very special guest, by popular demand. You may have heard him help us break down the X-Men feature film not too long ago. A longtime member of the Place to Be Nation family, Tim Capel is joining us. Tim, how are you tonight, sir?
I'm great, guys. Didn't realize I was a popular guest, but hope you all are looking forward to breaking down all of the Spider-Man movies that didn't get made over the years. I'm really pumped for that, so thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, that's going to be the primary discussion. And as for popular demand, quite frankly, our listeners will demand what we tell them to demand.
Oh, all right. Well, very good. I appreciate that.
Nick, tell the people what we've got for him this week in the countdown.
Absolutely. So with Tim on board, we thought it'd be a good time to count down our top five favorite Marvel crossover events. You know, right now Marvel is in the midst of their latest crossover, the aptly named Civil War II, which can get very confusing, as we've detailed, when talking about Civil War II number 4, or Civil War II number 3, or Civil War II number 1, as respective single issues. But that doesn't really have anything to do with anything we're going to be talking about, because we're talking about the top five Marvel crossover events.
Precisely. And folks, again, this is the usual disclaimer here. Now, these are our lists. This is one man's opinion, three man's opinions about the damn subject at hand. It ain't rocket science, folks. We ain't trying to split a damn atom here. If you have a problem with our list, for God's sake, form your own opinion or don't. I mean, it's as simple as that. It's not for us to say what your list is going to be. It's our list. Don't be a Richard. do not be a turd and try to tell us exactly how our lists are going. Our lists are our lists because they're our lists, quite frankly. Now, that's just what some might say. That's just my opinion. Now, some might disagree. Now, with all that cleared up, let's get started with our lists. Why don't we start off with you, Nick, at number 5?
Starting off with me, huh? I see how it is. All right. Well, you know, one of the things that I feel like I have a little bit different from you guys when it comes to my Marvel experience is, of course, my background in the Ultimate Universe. And so, you know, Greg, you said to me offline, off air, if you will, didn't most of the Ultimate Universe crossovers suck? And yes, most of them did. But there are two that I'm going to have in my top 5 that didn't suck. And the first of those, I'm going to go with Ultimate Comics Doomsday at number 5. Ultimate Comics Doomsday was actually a trilogy of 4-issue miniseries. And those miniseries were, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, they were Ultimate Enemy, Ultimate Doom, and Ultimate... Oh, man, I'm already Ultimate Mystery. There's the last one. Or the middle one, excuse me. So, yeah, Ultimate Enemy, Ultimate Mystery, Ultimate Doom. And basically, this was a story that picked up the pieces from Ultimatum, that after the events of Ultimatum, the Fantastic Four were kind of in shambles. They were one of the few titles, the only title in the Ultimate Universe that wasn't relaunched after the events of Ultimatum. So this is a story that deals with a mysterious figure who is attempting to remake the Ultimate Universe and alter various things. And eventually, you know, throughout the story, it is revealed that the ultimate villain of the piece, the ultimate doom, if you will, is none other than Reed Richards. So this actually gives us the heel version of Reed Richards that was brought over into mainstream Marvel continuity at the end of Secret Wars as the character The Maker. So one of the only enduring concepts from the Ultimate Universe that is still around today actually got its start in this story, and for that alone, it makes my top 5. Reed Richards has never been a character that I've cared a whole lot about, and I actually found the idea of a heel version of the character to be endlessly intriguing. And of course, the story, you know, I have to give a nod to my boy. It is written by my boy, Brian Michael Bendis, who does a great job on the dialogue, plots it out well, and the art is actually very good. Rafa Sandoval brings his outstanding stylings to the table. So, Ultimate Comics Doomsday, if you guys are going to check out any Ultimate Universe crossovers, I'd highly recommend this one.
Very good, Mr. Lau. I have not, of course, read that, but... it's interesting. I'm working my way through Ultimate Spider-Man. Well, by working my way in through it, I mean I've read 2 volumes, but I do plan on reading more Ultimate Spider-Man and perhaps even get into that one day. What year did that come out, by the way? Do you know?
Oh, let's see. I've got it right here. Let me look it up. It started in January of 2010 and lasted through March of 2011. So it was a 12-issue storyline that lasted a little, you know, right at a year. So...
I do remember that happening. However, after the shit show that was Ultimatum, I did the Jerry Seinfeld "I'm out" GIF, whatever you want to call it.
As I nearly did, yes.
On the Ultimate imprint. So I actually haven't read any of that, but you do make a good point in that it had some lasting repercussions, at least in the characterization of Reed Richards. Now, Greg, correct me if I'm wrong, but are you the person who has long held the opinion that Reed Richards is actually the greatest supervillain in the Marvel Universe just
yes.
through the sheer act of neglect alone?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
He's criminally negligent in his treatment and approach to the world. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure if I'm the one person that you're thinking of exactly, but I've always thought there are two schools of thought for me for Reed Richards. One, he's incredibly boring, or B, he's actually the biggest douche in the entire Marvel Universe who, by sheer selfish acts, has allowed things to happen that should not happen. By virtue of him being the smartest man, so we're told, who has ever lived.
Mm-hmm. And not doing anything about it.
And not doing anything, just stretching. Basically just stretching.
Just stretching.
And you can see Bunsen burners and whatnot.
One of the things
he's
I
made
forgot
a
to
career
mention,
out of warming up.
One of the things I forgot to mention is this story actually also gave us the short-lived Ultimate Ben Grimm, Ultimate Susan Storm marriage. This is where it got its roots as well.
That's
so wow.
Yep.
Certainly unique, some might say. A unique position to be in, quite frankly. I'll go next. I'll start off with my number five. And I actually called an audible as I'm talking. Because I have altered my list. I have stricken what was my number five from my list. Because
you've stricken or you've deleted?
Delete! Delete, delete, delete. Because I was originally like, I don't want to load it just with X-Men stories that I kind of remember from when I was a kid. So I threw another one on there, but I'm knocking it off. I'm taking it out. Annihilation Conquest, you're gone. You're finished, pal. Because in your place is a story that I know is highly revered by many and me as well. But it's a story that I don't remember that well, except just images here and there. The art, as will become a recurring theme here, the art is what I remember most about it. And that is Executioner's Song, which I suspect may show up a little bit later on Tim's list, perhaps.
I'll just say that unlike you, I shamelessly loaded my list up with some X-Men crossover, but we'll get to that. Spoiler alert.
This was a 1992-93 crossover that is probably most remembered as the Strife story. That's how I remember it, anyhow. I remember vividly these books coming out around that time. That was probably, by the way, that time period, the peak for me as a comic book reader as a kid, because Death of Superman was happening at the same time. Nightfall was just around the corner, I think. The build-up to Nightfall was going on. Executioner's Song. Death of Harry Osborn was just around the corner, I believe, or had just happened. So that time frame was like peak little Greg reading comics. And this just struck all the right chords for me. Like, random shit happening that you weren't entirely sure why it was happening, but it was happening. Which I loved at the time. Lots of pouches, lots of jagged-edged costumes. Strife was now, in hindsight, people can pick it apart if they want. To 8-year-old Greg, Strife was one of the coolest-looking villains ever. That red cape, the weird helmet that was completely impractical, the silver, like, metallic suit, the way they drew him with those scary eyes all the time. Basically, you...
Cool action figure, too.
Oh, awesome action figure. Awesome action figure. And, you know, they built it around the Cable and Strife conflict of what's the real story behind Cable's origin and who is Strife, really. And it was just a kid's fantasy, because a lot of the stuff you could make up in your mind of why it was happening, like, oh, I bet Strife is doing this because he's secretly Cable's long-lost father or something like that. Or, you know, just you can make up stuff in your mind, and it's perfect. Or, oh, man, I wonder if Cable's really like a future version of the Weapon X program. Stuff like that. It was just – there was just shit that you would have to make up in your mind, and it was great because of that for a kid. Like, it was just so much fun, so kinetic. The art – I'm looking at the list of artists here, pencilers. You got Brandon Peterson, Andy Kubert, Jay Lee, and Greg Capullo. I mean, that's a pretty good lineup of artists with distinctive styles who at that time, of course, were drawing in kind of the Marvel House style but doing their own little flair on it. I just loved it. It was visually stunning. It ended in a very kind of vague manner, which, as anybody who read 90s X-Men knows, vagary was a big recurring theme in X-Men comics at the time. Like, what are these guys' powers? Who are they? What are their origins? Who knows, really? We'll just kind of hint around at it and let the reader decide. For me, this is a story that holds a lot of nostalgic value because I still remember looking at the single issues on the shelf at the grocery store And especially when my mom would take me to the comic shop and I get to really pour through it and see all the tie-ins and everything. Just a fun story, in my opinion.
Yeah, and they were polybagged with a trading card with Strife's commentary, his very purple prose on various characters, various players in this particular event. Another hallmark of the 90s for sure. Worth noting, I think it can't go unsaid in any conversation about Executioner Song and the presentation of that event. If you kept any of those comics as they were originally sold in those poly bags, the acetate in the material itself would pretty much break down the paper. So any of those that are still in those particular bags have probably melted, which is a thing you don't think of paper being able to do. But yeah, that was a lesson learned probably the hard way. But, you know, such was the speculator era of Marvel Comics.
Absolutely. And I have to be honest. I never had a – I guess because I fell victim to all of it, I've never had a problem with all those gimmicks back in the day, like the bags and the cards and all that. Like, I mean, I remember as a kid, that was like crack to me. Like, I would buy the – if it had like a chrome cover, I would be like, oh, you got to get that for me. You got to get that for me, Mom. And I still remember one of my favorite Marvel comics was What If the Hulk Had Killed Wolverine, because the cover was so cool to me when I was a kid. It was like it almost looked like a steel cover, and I don't know. I kind of miss the weirdness and the creativity of those days. Understandably, it lost a lot of money in the long run, so I understand why they don't do it. But you know, just a sucker for that era, I guess.
Yeah, let's face it. That is what we showed up for as kids back in the day.
And is it a coincidence that there's not a lot of kids reading comics anymore?
Well, perhaps. A lot of reasons for that. Probably a separate podcast.
Right. Well, let's get to your number five, Tim. The number five pick on your countdown.
Well, I'm going to talk about my number five, but I guess it would be apropos while we're talking about it. You already – I knew there was going to be some crossover in our list of favorite crossovers. But, yeah, since you already mentioned Executioner Song, I guess with this being a top five, we're close enough, you know, to the finish line at any given point that I'll just say that was my number three, actually.
Okay.
Executioner Song, pretty much for the same reasons you named it. It was the height, it was the peak of impenetrable X-Men continuity of the 90s, which was really a selling point for that property. I mean, people talk about how horrible it is, how bad it is to look back on that, but I mean, that put the asses in the seats when you think about comics fandom of the 90s and the speculator boom. It was, I mean, the more obscure, the more enigmatic a character or a storyline, that's what people lined up for and wanted to see. Whether it ultimately panned out, made sense, they connected the dots or not, you didn't know that at the time. So you just thought, because they told you it was going to be important and monumental, that it would be. And they hadn't worn out their welcome at that point. I mean, this was 1992.
And importantly, we were at the age where we hadn't yet caught on to the game.
Yeah, you know, jaded in our young age. So, and you bring up a great point about the art as well. I think on an earlier edition of a giant size Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast, where we actually discussed big events in comics, not just Marvel, but pretty much across the board. You know, you guys had asked, what is it that makes a great comics crossover, a great comics event? And I probably said something sort of saccharine along the lines of, you know, it has to be an organic outgrowth of a character conflict, the culmination of many years worth of subplots and planning, and it all has to come together. But at the end of the day, now that I think about it, I think all I really ask for in a comic crossover is really striking art. And I know that's a really shallow answer, but in my head, when I revisit these things, that's what I'm gonna come down on. That's what my focus turns to is the visual representation. And when I look back on Executioner Song, it's just like you mentioned. It's that Brandon Peterson art on Uncanny X-Men. He was a pretty short-lived artist on that title, but did really great work, even, you know, within the house style of the time, mm-hmm. which was kind of just aping Jim Lee and the Image artists of the era, which, by the way, Image had just started at this particular junction as well. So, I mean, the comics industry was just firing on all cylinders, had never been hotter than at this point when Executioner Song was being published. Andy Kubert had just started on Adjectiveless X-Men. Say what you will about his style, but it was kinetic. It had a lot of energy. It carried the story off, even if he wasn't the best in terms of conveying subtleties and things of that nature. This was not a story that called for that.
Right. Strife was not a subtle villain.
Really. Not by any means. Early Greg Capullo on X-Force, you know, he basically turned that title into something that was readable for the first time in its existence. This is some almost 20 issues deep into the run. You know, Rob Liefeld was gone at this point. Fabian Nicieza was solely the writer on X-Force and had kind of been turning things around, but had been paired with some bad artists in the wake of the Image exodus. But man, that early Greg Capullo art, so good. Legitimately good, not just, you know, 90s good.
Right. I actually, as you know, Tim, through Twitter, I actually have a poster from Greg Capullo of the X-Men of that era that mm-hmm. I found from my childhood collection, and really, really good stuff.
Yeah, I liked that post. If I could like that post more than once, I would have. That was great. You know, you had Jay Lee on X-Factor. One of these tastes doesn't taste quite like the others, but it still sort of fit the kind of stories that Peter David was telling. He was a pretty reluctant participant in this crossover, as he is in basically all crossovers.
and also in all Fantasy Comics drafts.
And in Fantasy Comics drafts, at the risk of suggesting that perhaps Peter David should get over himself, I'll just say, when you start writing the X-Men in 1991, you better be down for some crossovers. And I only say that because he's bitched about it so hard over the years about, I got roped into this crossover, and then I got roped into the next crossover. It's like, dude, you knew what you were signing up for. Come on. I know it was a pain in the ass. If it was too much to work under, you know, you quietly take your exit, this, that, and the other. But to act like it was some, you know, affront against you is a bit much. But, I mean, having said all that, his work on X-Factor was uniformly pretty great. So, you know, begrudgingly or not, his contributions to that crossover were quite strong. So, I mean, and it was really cohesive. It was one of those crossovers where you had the structured part one leads into part two in this next mm-hmm. title. And it was 12 parts all told, four titles. So over and done with in 3 months tops. And this was one that Ben Morris called out as his absolute favorite of all of the X-Men events on the podcast I did on Sellers Points not too terribly mm-hmm. long ago with our compatriot Russell Sellers. And, you know, the lasting impression that was left with young Ben Morris was – Strife just berating Scott and Gene for being such terrible parents.
Yep.
And then having just no idea what he's talking about, much like the readers.
It's like, I love it. I love that so much. It's like all that you can picture in their place is Dr. Evil going, rah.
Yeah, you can recontextualize
like,
it.
His monologues were so long. That's what I remember most about this story is Strife's monologues would take up, like, I mean, pages of real estate of just him monologuing.
And the other characters are sort of looking at each other going, is it just me or what's he on about? You know,
what are you getting at there, sports fan?
Exactly. So while they're out on the surface of the moon suffocating, Strife is talking about all of the sins that were committed against him as a child, and they're just going, can you breathe? We need some help here. That's absolute peak of X-Men impenetrable continuity, X-Men high crossovers of the 90s for certain. And like you said, it definitely planted all of those seeds. It validated these fan theories that have been floating around for the past couple of years, really, surrounding the true nature of Cable and Strife. But it didn't go all the way in terms of confirming anything. That would come much later. And that's a recurring theme of X-Men events in the 90s for certain. It would be a little bit further down the line that they decided, you know, as much as we hinted that Strife was actually the child of the son of Scott Summers and Madeline Pryor, who he sent off to the future and has now come back to exact his revenge, we think we changed our mind because we want Cable to be that kid. And Greg just dropped off the call. And Greg is back.
I'm back. Sorry, guys. My power went out briefly and knocked out my
Very briefly, as it seemed.
Yeah, well, my Wi-Fi. I actually think that I'm 90% sure that Time Warner finally shut off my my internet there, because I haven't paid the bill.
They've had enough of your shit. You know, talking about Ted Turner, talking about you know, the heyday of wrestling, the Monday Night Wars. So, much like Executioner song, you know, the chickens have come home to roost here. But, it's funny, though. Like I was saying, Marvel just seemed to flip the script where they seem to be going for Strife is the biological son of Scott and Madeline, or Scott and Jean by way of genetic whatever. But then they said, no, we're going to say it's Cable instead. So they left enough of a back door that they could do that. They reserved the right to change their minds, and boy, did they do it later on. So, yeah, which just contributed to how convoluted that tapestry became over the years. But
wouldn't JR have been the ultimate PR guy for Marvel in that situation, though? Quite frankly, we never said Strife was their son. You said that. We never said it.
he could put a great
creative
spin.
For fans losing patience, folks.
He could put such a great spin on that, no doubt. So, yeah, that's actually my number three. I guess I should do my number five, right?
Yes.
Yes.
So this is one I'm confident that neither of you will have on your lists. I guess I should preface this by saying that my top five is unapologetic and very unbalanced at the same time. If we were doing a top 10, it might be a little bit more representative of Marvel's efforts and big event storytelling from across the decades. But when you get down to a top five, my list was awfully easy to come up with, and I didn't try to get too cute with it. So That being said, number five for me is actually an Avengers-centric event called Operation Galactic Storm.
Ooh, I've heard of this, but I've never read it.
You've heard of it, yeah. I'm not surprised that you haven't actually experienced the Galactic Storm. It was late 1991 into 1992. Again, an Avenger-centric story. It was 19 parts. But having said that, it did not drag for as long as you might expect, because the Avengers titles in the early 90s consisted of, deep breath, Avengers, Avengers West Coast, Captain America, Iron Man, Thor, who, by the way, was the Eric Masterson Thor at this
Nick's favorite.
Yep. The future worst. The future Thunderstrike himself. What else? We had Quasar. That's right. Quasar had his own ongoing series lasting some 60 issues. Again, yeah, the 90s.
Quasar,
folks.
Actually.
The 90s. Yeah, it was pretty good. And of all people, Wonder Man. Yep. Wonder Man had an ongoing series in the 90s. So this didn't last too long when you have that many titles involved, even though it was 19 parts. And basically it consisted of, here's the premise. It's in a way, a spiritual successor to the Kree-Skrull War of early Avengers comics in the late 60s. In this case, it's the Kree versus the Shi'ar Empire. So, you know, the Kree had been long established as this one of the great Marvel races spanning the cosmos. The Shi'ar had sort of been relegated to the X-Men books up until this point, but they were supposed to be these interstellar, intergalactic badasses with an empire onto themselves. So it made sense that they'd be drawn into these types of conflicts too. And sure enough, they go to war with the Kree. The Earth is caught in the middle of this struggle, because what's happening is these two warring races, empires, are utilizing a Stargate to transport supplies, ships, armadas, what have you, across their galaxies. And the issue with the Stargate is it draws energy from nearby stars in order to power itself. You use this too often, it has a very destabilizing effect on that star, could destroy the entire solar system. Well, it just so happens that the Stargate these two factions are utilizing is pulling energy from our sun. That's a bit of a problem. The Avengers realize what's going on, and they act to intercede. Their only interest is really, hey, can you stop using the Stargate? We really don't want our planet destroyed just as collateral damage due to whatever disagreements you guys have. Beyond that, we don't exactly care what your issue is. That goes disastrously, of course, and they get sucked further and further into this conflict. It's one of those great stories where it's a slow build and they have, you know, some room to stretch out. Again, 19 parts. And I would say it kind of exponentially escalates across all of these different series, takes a lot of twists and turns along the way. And what it comes down to is a rift in the Avengers ranks when the Kree Supreme Intelligence, he's a composite being of all of the great military minds of the Kree Empire from over generations of their evolution. You can kind of think of him as a Kree version of Serpentor from G.I. Joe, okay? Mm-hmm. And he's the dude who he looks like a head of lettuce with tendrils coming out of him. So no, real big hit in the tentacle porn community. Go ahead.
This sounds actually really familiar to me. I swear I have at some point experienced this story, though I haven't read it. Mm-hmm. Did they do this on Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes?
The series?
Yeah.
The animated series?
Yeah.
I think they did a version of it, yes.
Yeah, because I remember the premise being the two warring races are kind of drawing the energy away from the sun, and, you know, the Avengers have to kind of try and convince them not to do it, which doesn't go well.
You know, I almost feel like they sort of combined this with the original Kree-Skrull War.
Because I think they did.
I don't think the Shi'ar were. Yeah, there's no Shi'ar.
It was Kree and Skrulls, yep.
Yeah, so they sort of combined the two, which is cool in a way, because that was sort of a nice catalyst to this thing. You know, by all rights, the Avengers shouldn't really be that concerned with these two warring empires that has nothing to do with the interests of Earth, except it's going to get wiped out just in the course of them trying to annihilate one another. And they're completely indifferent to that, being as powerful as they are. Sort of the cool thing about this is the Avengers had some real heavy hitters within their ranks at the time. I mentioned Thor. You also had Wonder Man, who is a lot powerful than people give him credit for. Cersei, who is an Eternal, ungodly powerful herself. Quasar, he was kind of... Quasar's... The concept of Quasar was he was the protector of the universe. And it was kind of a riff on the Green Lantern Corps, but putting the Marvel spin on that, where he's kind of an ordinary guy tasked with this great responsibility, right? So he was Kyle Rayner before Kyle Rayner.
Right. To the unoriginality of Kyle Rayner.
But. Well, yeah, perhaps. Written by the late, great Mark Gruenwald. But again, another guy who, you know, you think of the power level of Green Lantern, basically the same thing with Quasar. And, you know, their first encounter with a Shi'ar armada, they just happen to get caught in the crosshairs. They pretty much annihilate them, much to the surprise of the Empire. They're like, oh, we sort of underestimated these guys. And I thought that
Empress
was a nice...
Lalandra, what should we do?
Exactly. And that's what it came down to. They got in over their heads. And I'm glad that the story acknowledged the power levels that were really on display here. And it was one of those, they had to assemble every Avenger who had ever been an Avenger kind of thing. Except for the Hulk, because Peter David didn't want to participate in this crossover. Kel Surprise. And they kind of lampshaded that at the beginning, since it started with Rick Jones being kidnapped because of the secrets that were in his subconscious dating back to the, again, original Kree-Skrull War. He tries to solicit help from the Hulk, who promptly tells him to fuck off, in so many words. So that was sort of funny, looking back on and knowing a little bit of the behind the scenes there. But it was just a really well-told story, tightly plotted, really cohesive. This was back when actually Bob Harris was writing the Avengers. Shamelessly love the Bob Harris Avengers run, actually. I think Bob Harris is a much better writer than he gets credit for. I would say it's a vastly underrated and underappreciated run that he had as writer on the Avengers. But that might just be my sentimentality and nostalgia speaking. But, you know, even looking back on it, it reads pretty well as an early 90s superhero crossover, at least the parts that were written by, you know, guys like Bob Harris and Mark Gruenwald. You had Tom DeFalco, Marvel's editor-in-chief, writing Thor at that time, take that for what it's worth, I guess. The Len Kaminsky Iron Man, sort of a forgotten run on Iron Man as well. But that's what brought us the ever popular modular armor that was so iconic in the 90s.
Modular.
Modular, yes. Quite so. You had art by the likes of an early Steve Epting on Avengers, sort of doing his best John Buscema impersonation, updated again with that 90s aesthetic. This was they call it the imagization of the Avengers with the leather jackets, all that stuff. That started under Epting, but he was a fine artist and a fine storyteller in his own right, even back then. Rick Levens, longtime Captain America artist, I think the late Rick Levens, unfortunately, sort of like a Rob Liefeld, but with a better sense of anatomy and storytelling. He still gets a lot of flack in online circles today, if you will, but again, is better than he gets credit for. Paul Ryan, who not our current Speaker of the House, but a guy who you guys would be more familiar with as the artist on Action Comics under the Roger Stern.
Oh my tenure. God!
Yeah, during Death of Superman.
Yeah.
So just before that, I think before it might have been after that actually. Because he also had a long run on Fantastic Four. But he was the artist on Iron Man. Gosh, what am I forgetting? You had Roy Thomas writing Avengers West Coast. He was the original writer on, again, the Kree-Skrull War. So
yeah, I'm surprised nice Roy Thomas there. was still getting prominent writing work in the early 90s. Because I don't remember much about him. He's kind of like, it feels like he was kind of pretty much gone by the time I started reading comics, but I guess he was still hanging around.
Yep, he was still hanging in there. He did Avengers West Coast for a good chunk of that title's history. He also wrote Doctor Strange. I think he had a brief Thor run as well. So yeah, he was still around, not really talked up very much in popular comic circles at the time, but yep, he was still in there doing his thing. But yeah, again, like I said, it's one of those stories that is you don't remember as being as good as it really is and holding up as well as it does. And it was an early, well, not really an early, but sort of continued a split in the ranks between the Avengers on either side of Captain America and Iron Man. Because a particular faction of the Avengers, to spoil a 25-year-old event here, decides they're going to execute the Supreme Intelligence for essentially decimating the Kree Empire with the Negabomb. It's pretty much a weapon of mass destruction that wipes out the Empire, instantaneously ends this war. And Captain America's stance is basically, this is horrific, this is awful, but you know what? It's over. We go home now. There's no threat to Earth anymore. That's it. And Iron Man and some other Avengers are like, fuck that. We're going to kill this dude because this is just straight up wrong. So, you know, a certain handful of characters decide to act on this, and as they go about the process of executing this, what they think is an artificial intelligence, but reveals itself to be a little bit more sentient and close to life as they recognize it after all, they experience some conflict and begin to realize this is a bit of a hollow victory in our part. It's not so much justice as it is vengeance, but maybe that's really what's called for here. And it kind of ends on that dark, depressing note where Everybody goes home just utterly disillusioned. Captain America ends up leaving the Avengers over this. It sets the team off on, again, that path of the imagization where they have kind of a harder edge to them. This is when Black Widow really steps up and becomes chairperson of the Avengers, leads that team through several years of 90s comics. Again, a forgotten chapter in Avengers history, but is worth taking a look at it if you've never read it before and you are any sort of Avengers fan. So it's probably enough said on Operation Galactic Storm, more than really needs to be said about Operation Galactic Storm, but I knew neither of you guys would mention it, so I had to give it some props.
Very good, very good. Moving on to number four, let's get Nick in on here. Nick, you've been left out in our 90s Marvel fangasms here. So bring us back to Earth with your number four selection.
Well, this is one we don't really need to say a whole lot on, considering we did an entire podcast about it not too long ago. And Greg, I think you knew this was coming on my list. At number four, I've got Civil War, the original Civil War.
I'm a little surprised it's not higher on your list, to be honest. I know that you have traditionally been a huge fan of it.
Yes. Well, I think you'll find that the other three that are ahead of it, I'm also a very, very huge fan of. So, this is certainly no knock on Civil War. And as we discussed on our standalone Civil War episode, this is just as much for the tie-ins, which I thought were excellent. The Amazing Spider-Man tie-ins, the Iron Man tie-ins, the Captain America tie-ins, as it was for the event series itself. This was my first introduction to the mainstream Marvel Universe. It's one that still holds a special place in my heart, even if I can agree that there were some missteps and some bumps and bruises along the way, specifically in how the story was wrapped up. But it's an event that continues to be very popular. You know, it sells well in trade. It's left a legacy. So much so that they're following up on it now. You know, they had the movie adaptation that was only loosely based on the comic story. But, you know, Civil War was just a force of nature at the time. I mean, it sold like gangbusters. Steve McNiven's art at that time, that was my first introduction to Steve McNiven. And, man, that art is still just amazing, amazing art. Still has some great iconic moments. The unmasking of Spider-Man, which they probably should have let, you know, play out a little bit longer rather than instantly doing away with it during the events of One More Day. But that's another topic for another time. Also had, you know, the somewhat, you know, the opportunity, it seemed like, to turn Tony Stark and Reed Richards a little bit more villainous than they had been portrayed in previous years. So I will agree there's some missed potential from this story, but overall, it's still one that I look back on fondly and certainly holds an important place in the Marvel mythos.
Yeah, you know, like you said, not too much more to say about this because we already have done an entire episode on it. But I thought it was kind of kicked off the era in some ways. I mean, there was House of M before it, but it really kind of kicked off the modern Marvel crossover age. And one can't argue, regardless of what my issues were with the actual miniseries, you cannot argue with the impact that it had bleeding through into, you know, one of the best comic book movies we've ever seen that came out this year. So, solid pick there at number four, Nicholas. And
yeah, if nothing else, I definitely appreciate that event for giving us Captain America: Civil War, the movie, which, I mean, I'll just go on record as saying I thought was better than the comic. But I did enjoy the recent podcast that you guys did revisiting that event because, Nick, I remember you being or I feel like you were much higher on it at first until you guys actually reread it in anticipation of your show together. And you both raised some really interesting, really valid points in that podcast, and I'm kind of right there with you, as I was sort of from the outset of this event, which I have some mixed feelings on, but no doubt, I mean, its significance alone certainly earns it a spot pretty high on anyone's list. I can, you know, I'm definitely good with that, regardless of my own feelings on the matter. So, yeah, I'm not surprised to see it there, and a worthy choice, a worthy contender for sure.
Moving on to my number four is one that I also don't have a whole lot to say about. Tim and I were discussing this before we went back on air, but I don't actually remember much about this story except the art, and that is Extinction Agenda, a 1990 X-Men crossover. I think this was X-Factor and Uncanny, and I don't think the regular X-Men title was out yet. Maybe New Mutants.
It was New Mutants. Yeah, it was Uncanny. It was X Factor and New Mutants. Just three of them. It was a nine parter, kind of quick and dirty. But yeah, it's and, a standout.
yeah. Claremont and Louise Simonson writing it, and the main reason I remember this is Jim Lee just killing it on art. This is the era of X-Men that I remember the best in terms of artistically, is the Jim Lee kind of iconic drawings of these characters. I mean, he was just knocking it out of the park. I mean, I know that the story involved Genosha, and they kind of loosely adapted it on the cartoon, with mutants being kidnapped and taken to Genosha. But Jim Lee's art was just so staggering that, I was six or seven years old when this came out, and I would have been six if it came out in 90. And so I was mainly drawn to the art, and I still can remember some of these images just burned into my mind of just how freaking killer the designs were, how kinetic the action was, the energy, the just overall artistic approach to this crossover was phenomenal, and I'll pretty much leave it at that. Rob Liefeld drew some of it as well, pretty much the preeminent artists of the day, the image artists, but this was the Jim Lee show for me.
Yeah, here's the thing. It's so funny that you mentioned that you're sort of bookending your two picks here, your first two picks with Executioner Song and Extinction Agenda, because it's so frustrating to me that we never got a proper X-Men crossover with all of the principal artists of the early 90s before, again, that Image exodus, which in my mind was, like you said, Jim Lee on X-Men, Rob Liefeld doing New Mutants, and soon to arrive on X-Factor, Wills Portacio. I hope I'm getting that right, even again after the Russell Sellers Point podcast with Ben. But that's my best effort. So Portacio had not quite arrived yet on the scene for X Factor. That meant that the X Factor chapters of that crossover were illustrated by John Bogdanoff.
Yeah, I knew from the Reign of the Superman era, right?
He did
Steel book, which Man of Steel. Yeah.
Yep, he did Steel, the spinoff John Henry Irons Steel book, and prior to that he was doing Man of Steel with Louise Simonson during the Triangle Number Superman era. So again, we're coming back to Superman with these artists. But it's funny, he, as great as a fit as he was for Superman, boy, was he ill suited for a team book, and especially X-Factor, at this time. And I just remember, Jim Lee illustrated one third of this crossover, and you are so right that those issues just pop when you read one of those Jim Lee X-Men installments in this crossover. You're just like, holy shit, I don't care what the words on this page say. This is incredible.
If somebody asked me at age 13, what does a superhero comic look like? That's what I would describe was the way that Jim Lee drew X-Men at that time.
And you knew it was just such a breath of fresh air for him, because he started on X-Men at a time when Claremont was kind of over it. he basically turned the X-Men into this sprawling Russian novel almost, where he had dismantled the team. He had a million subplots. I mean, even by Claremont's standard, he had so many subplots and so many plates spinning in the air. And there wasn't even a real team of X-Men for this long stretch. Yeah, this was like at the tail end of that Australia era where he just split the entire team up. There wasn't even a real actual X-Men team for the better part of a year. And that's when Jim Lee starts. And, you know, he's this kind of, you know, blue chipper artist who comes on to the scene here and wants to draw Magneto and wants to draw Wolverine and Cyclops and Storm and all the heavy hitters of the X-Men, and Claremont just didn't have in it. So this was his chance to just finally cut loose for the first time. And wow, does he make the most of it. And, you know, it's sort of a shame that Jim Lee never quite got a proper X-Men run. I know he had the very iconic work in the adjectiveless X-Men, where he was able to do his own thing. Just, it felt like it was almost too little too late, because he had been around for a while and was doing the kinds of stories that he didn't really want to do when he arrived on X-Men.
I think the big thing for me is I wish he had gotten a proper exit to the X-Men family, because yeah. I love all of his X-Men work, but it felt like he needed that big... He needed the X-Men version of Hush, basically. That big story where he could do his versions of all these iconic X-Men tropes and then walk away, and then that be...
A two-parter in Mojo World was not the way to go out for him.
No, right. Right. Well, anyway, that about does it for
me. What about a two-parter in Mojo Raleigh World?
He was hyped for it, that's for sure.
Just shoot me now.
Greg, you still hate Mojo Raleigh, don't you?
I still hate Mojo Raleigh. I'm sorry. I just don't.
I do too.
I don't think I'll ever get it.
Everyone does.
The mutants in the NXT zone are starting to turn around. anyway, moving on to Tim's number four. Tim, what do you have at number four, good sir?
Oh, what's my number four? Okay, my number four is the Infinity Gauntlet.
Oh.
Yay. Yeah, throwing it back to the early 90s here again. This is Jim Starlin's magnum opus, right? So he thought he had told his last Marvel stories for Thanos, Adam Warlock, and Captain Marvel. Of course, he did for Captain Marvel. But as fate would have it, he had the opportunity to bring Thanos back, bring Adam Warlock back as well, and tell this the most maybe cosmic level prolific story in the pantheon of the Marvel Universe. And, you know, you had stuff like Secret Wars before this, and I guess Secret Wars 2. But this was the first time where you had, you know, the entirety of the Marvel heroes being utterly decimated in a very visceral cinematic way. Again, Secret Wars did that too, but you never, it all kind of happened behind the scenes. It was not as in your face as this story was. So you had this great cosmic catastrophe, and then the reset button being pressed at the end of it, which we would see done many times subsequent to this to diminishing returns. But it's just a really cool story. I mean, at the heart of it, it's Thanos achieving ultimate power and trying to impress his crush and throwing a temper tantrum because she's none too pleased with his actions. She's, you know, not swayed by what he's trying to present to her. And isn't that the great folly in all our lives, really?
Oh, absolutely.
maybe not to such violent effect. But well,
speak for yourself, Tim. I myself destroyed a galaxy just the other day.
Well, all right. Well, far be it from me.
I destroyed a galaxy this morning. I'm up. I'm jumping around.
I hope Mr. Death was impressed by that. So, it's so cool because, you know, with the snap of a finger, he annihilates half of existence just like that, which, by the way, seems to comprise the entirety of the Fantastic Four, most of the Avengers, and all of the X-Men except for Wolverine and Cyclops, conveniently enough. So
they're forced to get along at last.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, it seems like the timing of this event was a little bit interesting because you had the X-Men really steamrolling into the 90s, and they were a little bit protective, it seems like, of their image and brand identity, and weren't too keen on participating in this event, which it was definitely up in the air how it would be received at the time, because this really wasn't the sort of thing that Marvel did. This was more like a DC event, now that I think about it, just the scope of it. Sort of thing that DC tends to do a lot better than Marvel, in all honesty. So, you know, the X-Men editorial office was a little gun-shy about participating. They said, all right, we'll give you two characters. Take your pick and do what you will, but we're not getting sucked into this one. We've got our own shit going on. And that's why the tie-ins to the original Infinity Gauntlet are stuff like kind of random issues like Cloak and Dagger and Sleepwalker and, here again, Quasar. You know, you don't see the major franchise titles that you associate with Marvel in the 90s, like Avengers and X-Men and Fantastic Four, stuff like this. They had very little part in this crossover, and yet it's still so memorable. Like I said, in writing, and George Perez on most of the issues, he bowed out, I think, in the middle of issue 4 because he was simultaneously writing and drawing Wonder Woman. And War of the Gods for DC.
Right, right. That was right around the same time, yep.
Yeah, it's sort of inconceivable today that you could have an artist on so many titles on a monthly basis. So Ron Lim took over on art, doing his damnedest to emulate George Perez. And Perez continued to ink it, so honestly, it wasn't that jarring, the shift. But just so many cool moments in this. Even after Thanos has beaten all the heroes, he gets confronted by all of these cosmic entities and elders of the universe who, you know, in the Marvel multiverse, you have abstract concepts personified as these sentient beings, like
Living Tribunal.
The Living Tribunal, my very favorite.
Yes, yep, mine too. Because he got sevens in every category.
Yes. On the Marvel trading cards, the Celestials who are inapplicable in their power ranking.
Yep.
And you know, Lord Order and Master Chaos and Love and Hate and Eternity itself, you know, all converge to confront Thanos, and he just straight up whips their asses.
Basically, yeah. Thanos was like Brock Lesnar, essentially.
Yes, he took them to Suplex City. Absolutely. He had Mephisto playing the Paul Great all around. Yeah. Six issues, mostly container. But it was all pulled together in a pretty great omnibus a few years back. could be purchased for the low, low price of about $125. But
you had me there, Tim. I was like, oh, I'm gonna write this down, and then you dropped that on me. All right.
Well, it really collects, like I said, the six issue series itself, all the tie-ins, and some like 15 or so preceding issues of Silver Surfer leading up to it. The Thanos Quest miniseries was just two issues. That's where Thanos actually collects all of the gems from the various enhancement talent that was in possession of them at the time. These folks, these are some straight up jobbers. I mean, we're talking the Grand Master, okay? The Gardener. I mean, who is the Gardener? The champion of the universe? That's overstating things.
Now, hang on. Are you suggesting he was the first ever universal champion?
Well, that's what he would say. So, in any event, that's actually worth the read in its own right, too. It's pretty cool the way that Thanos goes about assembling the gems, where he kind of picks the easiest one to go after at first and then just levels up from there, right? Until right. He has all six. So, yeah, I mean, you really can't go wrong with Infinity Gauntlet, a mad, omnipotent being throwing a temper tantrum because his crush just doesn't respect him. And it's so funny because Death brings him back because he's been such a great ambassador for her and, you know, killing folks. Tasks him with annihilating half of existence, which he does in order to impress her at her bidding. And after he gains possession of all of the Infinity Gems, he says, okay, is this enough for you? Now we're equals. And what she conveys to him through her various minions, because she doesn't interact with him directly, is I am still going to turn my gaze away from you because you are no longer my inferior now. You're my superior. So I can still not address you directly. And he's just like, are you fucking kidding me? You know, what do I have to do? I can't win with this woman.
God, first she doesn't like me because I can't control the universe. Now I control the universe and she doesn't want me.
And she likes me too much. It's just, I can't win. So, you know, Thanos, just the ultimate meninist here in the early 90s, before that's a thing. So, but yeah. I mean, just a fun read. Hopefully we're going to get to see it play out in some form or fashion in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You know, definitely looking forward to their take on that. But if you haven't read it, it's a classic. Track it down.
Yep. More on this a little bit later. Nick, I believe it's your turn for number three. Hit us up with your number three.
Absolutely. And so, you know, Tim mentioned that his list is kind of slanted towards the more classic events. Well, I'm about to hit you with the most recent big-time Marvel crossover event, and that is Secret Wars 2015. This is one I wasn't really expecting a whole lot out of when it happened. I gotta be honest, I read it mostly for the tie-ins, which I was really interested in, being able to revisit some old Marvel time periods and alternate concepts such as, you know, the Spider-Man Mary Jane marriage and Renew Your Vows, a concept which proved so popular it's getting its own ongoing series. But I wound up being blown away by how good Secret Wars was. Even not really understanding the full context, but because I hadn't read a ton of Jonathan Hickman's Avengers run or even his Fantastic Four run, which this, from what I understand, pulled a lot of elements from. This is a book that kind of hides what it is for a long time. Like it hooks you in with the premise that this is a something of a cosmic version of Game of Thrones, where Doctor Doom is sitting on this. Is wielding this power and sitting on the throne of Battleworld and dealing with all these barons of the various areas and whatnot. And what it winds up being in the end is, and this may sound like faint praise, but it's really not, the best Fantastic Four story I've ever read. Because in the end, you understand, and it's revealed that Doom has designed Battleworld to keep the Fantastic Four apart and to keep these various incarnations of the Fantastic Four from reuniting, because he realizes that they're the only ones who have ever really threatened him. And so it all comes down to the return of Reed Richards and Dr. Doom having this big emotional throwdown at the end, where Doom finally admits that, you know, despite all the power he had gained, the one thing he could never shake was that Reed would have done so much more with the power and been such a better wielder of it than he was. And you have so many great moments throughout, whether it's the way they handle the Thing, which I don't want to spoil for anybody who hasn't read it, which is a pretty cool reveal when it finally happens. This is just a really great event story that makes me want to go back and read some of Hickman's Avengers run to see what kind of plot threads he was dropping during the build-up to this. And, you know, one of the biggest things it has going for it is I've talked many times about my love for Asad Rivich, and his art here is just amazing. Plus, anytime you can get Alex Ross to do all the covers for an event for any kind of miniseries, that's a big selling point as well. Specifically, the cover to issue 2 is one of my favorite covers in the history of comics, where it has all the various incarnations of Thor all lifting their Mjolnirs aloft. So it's man, it was just a great ride, and one that I wasn't really expecting to enjoy as much as I did. But you know, nothing like the original Secret Wars. I know they borrowed the title for whatever reason. I still don't understand what that title had to do with anything that happened here. But I would highly recommend it to anyone who was hesitant about checking it out.
I am admittedly lower on Secret War than I should be. It's one of those things where I think I hyped it up a bit too much in my own mind. And the story that it was not the story I was expecting. Not that that is a bad thing or a detriment to the story that was. But it's one of those things where I know it's a grower over time, where I'm going to revisit this in a couple of years and realize this is a lot better than the first impression I was left with. I can already see that being the case, but it's sort of too fresh in my mind right now to have an objective stance on it, I feel like. But you are absolutely right in that it swerves you into thinking into making you think it's one thing, but ends up being the best Fantastic Four story you've ever read. And being someone who hasn't been super high on Fantastic Four at any point ever, I'm kind of like, it absolutely fulfills the potential of that concept in a way that I think has maybe never been done. Because at the end of the day, it does come down to a very, very character-focused arc and the culmination of all of the history between Reed and Doom. And just pays it off so magnificently. And I like I said, I don't appreciate that as much as I know I should, but I think I'll get there.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to sell me on a book when the Fantastic Four are the main characters, cause
that's the thing, though. They're really not the main characters. I can't really describe it, but I think Tim knows what I mean in that Reed and the rest of the Four don't really play integral roles in most of the issues.
And that's the point. And you don't know that that's the point until, oh, wait a minute. This story is.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost a bait and switch, but in a good way, I thought. Because you can't sell a major Marvel event around the Fantastic Four these days. I mean, you're just not going to be able to do it. And this was, I think, Hickman's way of getting around that.
Yeah, and I kind of admire him for doing so and pulling it off.
Yeah, absolutely pulling it off. And I actually thought, like, And plus, we talk all the time about how, like, comics are never allowed to have an ending. This reads like the most logical and somewhat poignant ending to the Doom and Reed rivalry that you could possibly come up with. In that, you know, at the end of the day, Reed comes off like a hero. And, like, he absolutely... you are led to believe that he gives Doom everything Doom had ever wanted, you know, in terms of reconciliation between the two, and, you know, specifically referring to the events that left Doom disfigured or whatever. That closing shot of Doom in Latveria and, like, the sheer joy that Ribbitch draws on his face when he realizes that, spoilers, he's no longer disfigured under the mask, that's just a fantastic moment. And you see that despite their years of disagreement, despite their years of history, in the end, Reed was still willing to help him. And that's just a really cool notion about what it means to be a hero.
Yep. Well said. And a crowning moment of badass for the Black Panther, too. All right.
Oh, my God, yeah. The preliminary, the opening salvo in the final battle is actually between the Black Panther and Doom. And it's a pretty cool damn fight.
Well, very cool. I will have to check it out one day. Moving on to my number three, a sprawling epic. Undoubtedly, I would imagine the longest of any of the crossovers that are on our lists. And that would be the 1995-96 X-Men event, Age of Apocalypse.
Ooh.
Popularized in action figure form by the coolest Apocalypse action figure there's ever been. Also popularized in comics for years. They've gone back to this well over and over and over again. I have to admit, it's a story that when it happened kind of lost me a little bit. Like, I wasn't as enthralled with it as many of my friends were. But in hindsight, I think time has been very kind to it, and I find myself remembering it more fondly than I used to. Basically, the event revolves around Legion, Professor X's son, going back in time to kill Magneto and screwing up and killing Xavier instead. And it sets off a chain of events that leads to an alternate universe where Apocalypse rules everything, hence the title. And all of the X-Men characters you know are there, just in different forms. And boy, you want to talk about committing to an event. I don't know that I've ever seen a comic book company commit to an alternate universe concept the way that the X-Men line of Marvel Comics committed to the Age of Apocalypse. It was really impressive. And you see all these, you know, crazy concepts running around, drastically different versions of Wolverine, Magneto leading the X-Men, or a version of the X-Men anyway. Cyclops almost like crossed with his space pirate dad in a way. kind of just a cool event that lasted over a year, or about a year, and had ramifications for years to come. Like, one of the issues with events now is it feels like they don't really have long-term ramifications. Age of Apocalypse did. I mean, it introduced characters that stuck around for years as alternate versions. Dark Beast, for instance, was a character that came out of Age of Apocalypse. The Sugar Man, everyone's favorite, the Sugar Man, stuck around for many years after Age of Apocalypse. So this is a very 90s event that is always going to represent, I think, a high mark of sorts for the creativity of the 90s. For all the crap that the 90s get, there was a lot of good stuff, and there was a lot of good stuff, particularly out of the X-Men line of comics, and this is one of them.
Ooh, I'm biting my tongue super hard because this is going to show up on my list too. I'm at a bit of a conundrum here because I gave you my number three. And Executioner song already, and I can't talk about Age of Apocalypse yet.
Right.
So
we'll go ahead, and since you've already given us your three, we'll skip you for now. We'll come back to you for your two. Okay. Let's go ahead and go to Nick for Nick's number two.
I'm going to go with another event out of the Ultimate Universe, one of the earliest Ultimate crossovers, and that is Ultimate 6. This was the introduction of the Ultimate version of the Sinister Six. It was also a crossover between Ultimate Spider-Man and the Ultimates. And basically, the premise of this was that the Ultimates had, at some point, you know, captured villains such as Electro, Kraven the Hunter, the Sandman, Doc Ock, and Norman Osborn, and were holding them all prisoner indefinitely. And eventually they are able to escape, and you know, Osborn basically goes on this mad power trip about how, you know, Fury had held him without any, you know, legal recourse, without, you know, any consideration for him or whatnot. And what winds up happening is Osborn decides to go on this tirade against the United States government, and basically he winds up kidnapping Spider-Man and forcing him against his will to help him attack the White House. He threatens Mary Jane and Aunt May. He says that Oscorp has actually kidnapped both of them and has them in custody and is threatening to murder both of them if Peter doesn't join them. So Peter actually winds up being the sixth member of the Sinister Six in the Ultimate Universe. And so Osborn's leading this attack on the White House, the Ultimates show up, and it leads to this big climactic battle, but, you know, between the two, and Captain America is eventually able to free Aunt May and Mary Jane, and you see in the middle of the battle, like, Peter just get this really pissed off look on his face, and he just beats the ever-living hell out of Norman Osborn. And it's this really cathartic moment, because to that point, in the Ultimate Spider-Man run, Peter had only ever beaten Norman through sheer luck. He had never really gotten the better of him, really, in a physical fashion. And this was just, you know, 45 issues of build to Peter finally getting the beatdown on Norman. And the moment that actually enables Peter to gain the upper hand is Fury uses Harry Osborn and actually sends him onto the battlefield, causing a distraction. And Harry actually stands there and watches his best friend beat the ever-living hell out of his dad. And that actually sets up Harry's motivation for eventually becoming a villain in the Ultimate Universe. So it's actually setting up a lot of story that's played off down the road and giving Harry a motivation to dislike Nick Fury for using him in that way, and also, you know, to have a beef with Peter for beating his father so severely. So, not a very, like, you can't really say it's a story that's wide in scope, because essentially it is, you know, a Spider-Man story, for lack of a better term, but the Ultimates played such a key role in it, and it's still one of my favorite story arcs of Ultimate Spider-Man that in that long run. So, for that reason alone, it had to make my list, because great Ultimate Spider-Man story that was technically a crossover.
Yeah, I remember that one. I'd forgotten about it until you brought it up, but it's a dandy. You're right. Anyone who I think is a fan of Ultimate Spider-Man and that run, that, gosh, how far into Ultimate Spider-Man was it before that came along?
And this takes place directly after Ultimate Spider-Man 46.
Yeah, so Bendis and Bagley are pretty deep into their run. So if you're a fan of what they're doing, it's a super good payoff. And you can never go wrong with Peter just beating the ever-loving shit out of Norman Osborn.
Which is what it was. The only downside to this story is that it is that cathartic moment, but Bagley doesn't draw it. They actually Trevor Harrison as the penciler on this issue for whatever, or for on the story arc for whatever reason. Wish Bagley had drawn this, but
you know. He was one of the young guns in the mid-millennium. Remember when Marvel was doing that, playing up their cachet of artists around the time of, I want to say, started in 2005, 2006-ish with House of M and going into Civil War. They had just this stable of artists that they were pushing really hard.
You know, and I say that I wish Bagley had drawn it, and I do, but I can kind of understand why Harrison got the nod, because he does have a very Brian Hitch style, so it fit with the usage of the Ultimates. And, you know, you obviously weren't going to be able to get Brian Hitch, because Ultimates was plagued with delays at that point because of the art. And, you know, so it winds up working thematically, I think, to make it feel like an Ultimate story. But still, you know, because that moment hadn't really happened and it had been built to so well, you kind of wish Bagley had gotten the nod there.
Yeah, he was sort of a compromise, it seemed like, between Bagley and Hitch. I don't know that I would have wanted to see Brian Hitch illustrate this story, even if he had been available or timely. It wasn't really the kind of story that I think I associate with him.
Right.
Between the two, I definitely would have taken Bagley, but I can see how, you know, they give the nod to the kind of hot up and comer. Which, gosh, what is Hairsign doing today? Do we know? He seems to have
not a clue. And he actually only drew the last six issues of the seven issue story. Joe Quesada actually drew the first issue.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay.
Joey Q. Well, that leads to my number two story, and that is, or crossover event rather, that is one that is higher on my list than it will be in anyone else's. I don't care. I love this event. I love the gimmick covers of this event, the hologram trading cards that
were
glued to the front of the covers of this event. I love them unabashedly, and that event would be Fatal Attractions. The 1993, stop me if you've heard this before on my list, X-Men crossover event. Fatal Attractions. This one I do remember very well, because this was peak Greg in the X-Men era. Like, pretty much starting Executioner's Song, leading into this was... This was peak era for me. This is when everybody at my school pretty much was reading X-Men comics, arguing about X-Men comics on the playground and in the lunchroom, about who's Strife, about what's Wolverine's real origin, about what's Cable's deal, you know, all this stuff. We would have vociferous arguments about that, who would win in a fight between this character and that character. And this was kind of the pinnacle of that. This story has a very strong nostalgic value for me, because it represents being a kid. It represents that the feeling that I had when I was a kid and I didn't overthink comics. And it's weird because I say I didn't overthink them, but I kind of did, because we kind of all did. But it was
in that fanboyish sense, not in the critical sense,
right.
That maybe
we weren't picking apart the
jaded old men.
Yeah, we weren't picking apart the writing or the art. We were just picking. We were overthinking it in a fun manner of, like, it was sparking our own imaginations. And basically, this is an event that saw the return of Magneto after he was presumed dead.
Yep.
And it also, one of the centerpiece characters is one of my kind of guilty pleasure favorite X-Men villains, Fabian Cortez.
Oh, God.
Yep. Guilty pleasure. Just the most. There is nothing redeeming about this character. Like, he is,
would you care to try to explain his powers for the viewers at home?
As best I recall, and I believe you would have to, you may have to pick it up for me here. But as best I recall, he had the ability. His only real ability that I can remember was he made other mutants more powerful.
Yes.
So basically, he had to kiss Magneto's ass perpetually, but it was a symbiotic relationship, because Magneto didn't want to kill him ever, because he needed Fabian Cortez to make him more powerful.
Yes, the idea was that he was using his abilities to heal Magneto from injuries that he had sustained in his fights with the X-Men, when in fact, all he was doing was... basically getting him high, so that he didn't realize how badly his shit had been wrecked.
Yep. And in some ways, it was like almost predicting what the direction that Morrison went with Magneto and his run with
Magneto
as drug addict. But in this in this way, it was Fabian Cortez, the master manipulator, who is basically he's the dealer, and Magneto is his client, the user, who can't get enough and doesn't even understand how deep into the addiction he is, because he doesn't know that there is an addiction.
He doesn't exactly. He becomes increasingly dependent on him, and by the time he actually realizes what's going on, it's too late. He's literally, literally coming apart at the seams, and that was what led to Magneto's supposed death in the opening salvo of Jim Lee's X-Men, that three-parter. And like you said, this is where he comes back, and boy, does he have some words and some actions to express his disdain for one Fabian Cortez.
Yes. This also introduces Exodus, who was another in the classic mysterious early 90s X-Men villain characters that they, if you remember, they introduced Exodus and you had no idea like who he was or, again, what his deal was.
By the way, I'm sorry to keep interrupting you.
No, that's all right.
I feel like this is maybe just fan theory, but I think that the name Exodus was maybe a play on the image Exodus, which I don't know if that term was even really used in the public consciousness at the time, but I just sort of, it's such a kind of striking and distinctive word and a very nonsensical code name for this character. So I almost feel like it was maybe a play on that, because all the Image founders were long gone by this point. And this was sort of Marvel trying to prove that they still had it, you know what I mean? And they could make a go of it without these guys. And while I'm at it, I should mention, I think that Fabian Cortez is a play on Fabian Nicieza.
I
think that Claremont had some ill feelings there, and he's the Judas, blah, blah, blah.
Here's the creative team for this one, by the way. I'm looking this up right now. Fabian Nicieza, Scott Bell is the writers. And then your artists are the two Kubert brothers, Greg Capullo, Joe Quesada, Ken Lashley, and John Romita Jr. So still a pretty all-star list of creators there, particularly at that time. And this was a massive crossover. Excalibur, Uncanny, Wolverine, X-Factor, X-Force, and X-Men all crossed over for this. But basically, like, Magneto comes back and he's pissed, and he's recruiting mutants to come to his new base in the sky, which happens to be Cable's former base in the sky. And they're just going to – he's taking all the mutants up there, and they're going to wreck the human shit, basically. Yeah. Well, this is where my fond memories of this come in, of this crossover, because I will never forget when the issue where they crash the funeral of Ilyana Rasputin.
Oh, my God.
His sister. They crash the funeral and have this just badass, monstrous confrontation. And do you remember the Bishop scene, Tim?
Yes. So they're all Magneto's basically got everyone immobilized. He's manipulating the iron in their blood, right?
Yeah!
They can't do it. They can't move. They can't use their powers. They can't do anything. But Bishop is, you know, he's powered by kinetic energy, right? Which he releases in the form of his bio blasts, whatever that means. And so he's feeding on this the whole time it's going on, and just getting more and more powerful.
Picture Goku charging up the spirit bomb on Dragon Ball.
exactly. And then you have some other characters who are kind of catching wind of what's going on here. So I think Storm hits him with some lightning, Cyclops blasts him, and they're like, sorry about this, but, you know, this hurts me more than it does you, and you'll make the most of it, ha, ha, ha. sure enough, Bishop just lets loose, and he pretty much pushes Magneto's shit in.
yeah.
In a way that nobody had.
This awesome splash page of this massive blast. I remember just thinking at 9 years old, this is the coolest thing I've seen all year. Like, it was just, it was such a badass blast. But then, unfortunately, of course, it didn't work.
Right. And because, yeah, and this was a John Romita Jr. illustrated issue, who he was always really good at that epic scale. I'm thinking back to his Thor run, where you just had, you know, I'm just picturing the curvy dots and the energy blast.
Right,
and
curvy dots everywhere.
The massive destruction of scenery and buildings collapsing and just the whole nine yards, which was on full display here. And these were all double-sized issues, I want to say, with the holograms. So, yeah, that one certainly stands out in my mind, too.
What perhaps for most people this story is most remembered for is, of course, this is the story where Magneto rips the adamantium out of Wolverine's body, which was, for a young Wolverine fan like me, was a big moment. It also, this story also revealed one of the long-lasting secrets of Wolverine's background that had never been known, which I suppose was probably a retcon, but this was the first time they ever revealed that the claws were actually a part of his mutation, skeleton. That was part of his skeleton. For years, people just assumed that the claws were implanted by Weapon X, which maybe you can correct me on this, Tim. I think that was the original idea.
I don't know if there really even was an original idea. They just sort of went with it and made things up.
That's fair. Yeah, especially by that point. Yeah. The adamantium's ripped out of Wolverine's skeleton by Magneto, giving us the ill-fated bone claw era of Wolverine.
Oh man!
And then at the end, of course, Xavier is so pissed about that Xavier counters by mind wiping Magneto, which set into action several events that would take place over the next several years, culminating in an onslaught. So
it's a retcon, but kind of works for what they did. So, do you know the backstory behind Wolverine getting his adamantium ripped out?
No, I don't. Tell me.
So real quick, Fatal Attraction's the follow up to Executioner's Song in 1993, big X-Men editorial office summit with all the creators, right? Where they're gonna plan out their next event, and they're sort of stumped for what to do. How do they top themselves? And they know that they've pretty much got their heart set on, we're gonna bring back Magneto. He's got to figure into this somehow. That's a given. So what's the big action set piece? What's Magneto going to do here? What's really going to move some books? And Peter David facetiously suggests, you know, why don't we have him just pull Wolverine's skeleton right out? You know, it's made of metal. Magneto is the master of magnetism. Why hasn't he done this already? He just yanks his skeleton right out. Why don't we do that, right? And he's being sarcastic in suggesting this. And everybody, there's kind of that hushed silence that falls over a room. And, you know, Bob Harris kind of does a, well, now that you mention it. And that was sort of Peter David's last straw with the X-Men. But that was his insincere idea that they actually ended up running with.
That's somewhat similar to the origins of Death of Superman in that regard.
Yeah. Why don't we just kill him?
Yeah.
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 That was, was that Carl Kiesel who threw that out?
No.
I thought it was Wheezy Simonson, right?
No. It was Jerry Ordway, I think.
Ordway, okay.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
And just kind of like, just throwing it out there just as a...
Let's just kill him.
Yeah, let's just kill him. And then apparently he had thrown it out at every summit for the last several years, and this was the one where they actually stopped, and they were like,
It was like a big running joke, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But in this case, this was Peter David going, I'm dealing with idiots here, and he was kind of just done with it and washed his hands of the X-Books after that. But, wow, it paid dividends, huh?
Yeah, but no, so anyway.
He bounced back okay. He went on to, you know, have a very successful run with Miles Morales, so it's all good.
Yes, in Black Panther.
Indeed. And with that being said, that's my number two pick, controversial though it may be. Now, Tim, hit us up with your number two.
Well, I guess if my number two is not Age of Apocalypse, and I mentioned it would come up later, then I pretty much spoiled myself here. But you don't know what my number two is. I'm going to reveal that right now and tell you that in keeping with the theme here, it's Inferno. Another X-Men-centric event, but in my defense, this one did kind of span and spill out to the entirety of the Marvel Universe.
Yes.
Structured more like Onslaught, I would say, if there's anything I could compare Inferno to in terms of any other events.
And it's not our fault, Tim, that the X-Men had all the best crossovers.
No, it's really not. Well, it's like I said, with Marvel crossovers, I feel like DC does the universe-wide crossovers better, but Marvel is better at doing crossovers within their individual editorial fiefdoms, so to speak. So you've got your Avengers crossovers, you've got your X-Men crossovers, and you know, even Spider-Man crossovers. Hell, the Punisher had his own crossovers in the 90s because he had
books.
So, yep. But anyway, that's getting off point. Inferno was a late 80s. It was actually the first and probably biggest crossover that didn't have a companion miniseries. You know, it wasn't Secret Wars, which had the 12-issue maxi series as kind of its spine, but it was bigger than, say, a Mutant Massacre or a Fall of the Mutants, which preceded it. Because while it was X-Men-centric, it involved the Avengers, Fantastic Four, Daredevil went over into, you know, Power Pack of all things, Cloak and Dagger. All the Spider-Man books that I can think of, and basically what happens here is it's the intersection of two rather important subplots that have been running through the X books for the better part of about 3 years. Where on the one hand you have Madeline Pryor, whose true nature is finally revealed both to her and to the readers. She is, in fact, a clone of Jean Grey. No great surprise there. But what is rather shocking is that she owes her existence to the Phoenix Force. So going all the way back to the original Phoenix Saga, when who we thought was Jean Grey sacrifices herself on the moon, blows herself to atoms, it would turn out that, in fact, this was not our Jean Grey, but a cosmic entity that essentially impersonated Jean Grey to the point that it believed it was Jean Grey and, for all intents and purposes, could have been Jean Grey. Anyway, this being a cosmic entity, it isn't truly dead. It then tries to revive Jean, who is recuperating in a cocoon on the bottom of Jamaica Bay. Kind of a long story, but anyway, that doesn't work out because our Jean rejects this entity and the acts that it has committed in her name. It then goes on to find the lifeless clone, a husk of Jean Grey that Mr. Sinister has created and more or less discarded because it's of no use to him. This, having no free will of its own, the entity is able to inhabit and imbue with a consciousness. And that's how Madeline Pryor comes about. As a person, she's amnesic, but she seems to fit Mr. Sinister's purposes at this stage. He's going to use her as a surrogate gene. Gene. Play on words there. Pairs her up with Cyclops. They're going to produce a son who Mr. Sinister can use as his ultimate weapon against Apocalypse. All this would be revealed actually much later down the line. However, that's the convoluted, twisting origin of Madeline Pryor. And so upon learning that she has been created as a broodmare, as you know, disturbing as that revelation is, she decides she's going to take some agency upon herself, reclaim her life, and is tempted with ultimate power and with the ability to exact revenge on her enemies by a demon from Limbo. Now, Limbo is the hellish realm that is ruled over by Ilyana Rasputin, Colossus's sister. Yes, that's right. Colossus's sister is a demon sorceress because comics. So gradually, and this is the intersection of the two main storylines here, gradually Ilyana has been sort of losing her grip on Limbo. You've got demons and demonic influence sort of spilling over into the Marvel Universe proper, and she's not really able to rein that in ways that she has done before. So a particularly powerful demon tempts Madeline, grants her ultimate power, and she uses that to essentially conquer New York in a demonic invasion. Here again, with Ilyana's grip over Limbo really falling by the wayside, she's exploited by some of her enemies, and basically a big old portal opens from Limbo to Earth, spilling out all of these demons. They start possessing inanimate objects, like, for instance, a mailbox that eats a dude that's depositing letters. Daredevil has an extended battle with a vacuum cleaner that's demonically possessed. The lions in front of the New York Public Library are animated, you know, just like straight out of something from Ghostbusters, which I feel like visually this event owes a lot to, actually. So it's all illustrated by, well, not all of it, but principally you had Mark Silvestri on X-Men. We've talked him up in great detail in the past. Such a superbly expressive artist, was a great fit for an event like this, where he could really cut loose. And Walter Simonson on X-Factor, right? So as much as a fan as we are of his Thor work, where he's drawing all kinds of colorful characters in Asgard, he can kind of bring that now over to the X-Books too, with all these demons and creatures that are now just commonplace in the city. So this happens to be the first meeting between the X-Men and X-Factor after some, oh gosh, about 3 years of keeping the two teams apart. The X-Men actually didn't know that Jean was back from the dead through various contrivances. They were kept apart for that long. Showed a lot of discipline on the part of the X office to really pull that off and to pay it off here with that first meeting of the two teams. It's sort of the tragic ending to Ilyana, who, for my money, is actually the most tragic character in all of the X-books. including, you know, the likes of Magneto. You know, she just has such a horrible, traumatic backstory, and she kind of gets a second chance at life at the end here, where she's she gives up her power, is reverted to childhood once again, and then what happens in the story that Greg just described, Fatal Attractions. This takes place during her funeral because she contracts the legacy virus and dies as a little kid. So it doesn't really get much worse than that as comic book characters go. But it was just the culmination of all of these swirling events that, were really hard to kind of make sense of and track if you hadn't been following it. You know, and being a committed reader of the X books, and locked into the stories that they had been presenting over, you know, again the past 3 years or so. This is also where you get the demonic version of the Hobgoblin over in Spider-Man, where who was it? Jason McIndale is like bonded with a demon and has that kind of grotesque appearance that became rather iconic for that character through the Todd McFarlane depictions later on.
Not to be confused with Demogoblin, who was a different character later on.
Well, not quite, actually. It turns out when this is me getting super geeky as if I haven't already. Jason McIndale, Masondale, however you say it, was separated from that demon. That demon went on to become Demogoblin.
Oh, yes.
So they do have a connection, and Demogoblin was around, or Demogoblin, whatever you want to, however you want to say it, was around to plague Spider-Man and the readership, arguably, for several years. So, yeah, that was an unexpected lasting consequence of Inferno. But, yeah, it was the first really big X-Men event that was like the culmination of something. You know what I mean? Where it wasn't just, this is our big annual story. It was the payoff of a bunch of years' worth of stories. So, yeah, I mean, anyone who was a regular X-Men reader, and knew that all this was building to something, but you didn't know what it was going to be, this is where it all just came to a head. So we talk about some of these events from the 90s as being impenetrable, but Inferno is sort of up there too, because here again, while it didn't leave anything hanging at the end, you couldn't just come in at the ground floor and really know what was going on. You had to have that context in order to, I think, fully appreciate the story for what it was.
Yeah. Well, with all that being said, I'm going to switch things up and let Nick go after me. I'm going to go ahead and do my number one because it's already been talked about.
As has mine, sir.
Is the Infinity Gauntlet.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Wow.
Heel Heat, the graphic novel. anybody who knows me and my tastes in pop culture know that I love a good monster heel in fiction, whether it be the Brock Lesnars of the world in pro wrestling, whether it be Bane in DC Comics when he, you know, breaking Batman's back. I'm a sucker for Nightfall. Doomsday killing Superman, one of my favorite moments and one of my favorite stories, not moments, but stories in comics.
Your heartless bastard.
I know. I needed to correct myself there, Lord. The Sinestro Corps War. You know, I'm a big fan of stories that have monster heels that really do damage to the good guys. And it don't get no more massive, ladies and gentlemen, than the Infinity Gauntlet for that, because Thanos is the ultimate monster heel in this. Just a he is the kind of heel that I feel like Grant Morrison wanted Darkseid to be in Final Crisis, but couldn't quite pull it off, because Thanos just, he doesn't philosophize, he philosophizes, but he does it while just laying the smackdown on every hero in the Marvel Universe without effort, without even trying. He just does it. And it's truly unique in superhero comics, because it's a story in which from the outset, the superheroes have zero chance of winning in a straight-up fight. And it's a great story. It's Jim Starlin at his best, in my opinion. It represents cosmic Marvel at its best, which I've always thought has been kind of the underappreciated gem of Marvel's universe, is their cosmic line. And this is kind of it at its best, the cosmic Marvel when it's clicking on all cylinders and feels important and feels like it matters. I can't say enough about this. I am so excited to see them approach this in the movies, hopefully with the same level of care that it was approached in the comics. And that's all I have to say about it, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have certainly said, everything that pretty much needs to be said about this. It's a fantastic story. I will say that I revisited it maybe about 4 to 6 months ago, and so many stories from the 90s, when you sit down and read them, you're kind of like, man, this doesn't really hold up in a modern context. But I think the Infinity Gauntlet absolutely holds up. I was stunned by how well it reads and how un-90s it feels at times. I very much enjoyed it. Not to say it isn't, very much a 90s story, but it's not as dated as something like Nightfall, I would say. Love this book. Couldn't believe how well it held up in retrospect. And like you guys, can't wait for the big screen version.
I'm impressed. Both you guys going number one with Infinity Gauntlet. You know, the one thing that I think I would respond to, if I were respond to the naysayers with the obvious criticism of, if Thanos can just snap his fingers and annihilate half the population of the Earth, why is he even fighting all these guys? Why doesn't he just wipe all them out too? Well, they actually made a point within the story of saying he's doing this because he wants to put on a show. He's again trying to impress his girlfriend, essentially.
Right.
And while they don't stand a chance, he actually, there's a moment within the story where he says, I'll reduce my power just to give you guys half a fighting chance. You're not going to win because I'm not going to let you, but I'll let you go ahead and fight the good fight.
Right. And I've always thought that criticism ignores the entire point of Thanos' character.
Yeah.
If Dr. Doom had that power, then yes, there's no reason why Dr. Doom wouldn't just subjugate everyone instantly and it'd be over with. If Apocalypse had that power, he'd just kill everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But Thanos does all of this for a reason, and it's not because he wants just power for the sake of power. He's doing it to impress, his one-sided love interest.
Yes. Basically. He's very much motivated by ego. It's not so much the end goal as it is putting on a great show, a spectacle, and that's what it was to Thanos and really to the readers. And what stands out in my mind, I'm just picturing when I think of the Infinity Gauntlet, what's the one image that comes to mind when I look back at that story and visualize it in my head? It's Thanos standing there going, come and get me, and just beckoning the heroes and just tempting them and knowing that he's just going to hand them their asses.
Yep, that's a line that actually permeated into a lot of my fiction writing when I was in middle school and high school, actually. I always envision. I always like to write the heel or the villain of the story as being like as having that attitude of the whole let them come. You know what I'm saying? Like, yep. Embracing whatever is to come. Or Khan kind of does the same thing in Wrath of Khan, kind of playing off the same concept. But anyway, that's beside the point. number one for you, Tim. I think I'm. In fact, I know where you're going with this.
So. Yeah, no surprise here. It's Age of Apocalypse. So for all the reasons that you already mentioned, Greg, and I'll just stress, I guess, if there's anything that to this day really impresses me about that story, it's how well thought out you can tell the thing was. I mean, the creators on this, you mentioned Scott Lobdell, Fabian Nicieza, under the editorship of Bob Harris and all the other creators along the way. They showed their work in putting this thing together. They had to be pretty tapped out creatively at this point, I feel like. They had just done – they'd been doing one of these crossovers annually. So, you know, we already mentioned Executioner Song, Fatal Attractions. Phalanx Covenant didn't make any of our lists, probably for good reason. But it was just 4 months prior to Age of Apocalypse that they had wrapped up their last event, launched Generation X, the new series, and we're only 4 issues into that. And now all of a sudden they've got to do another big X-Men-centric event that's going to take up a big chunk of the publishing calendar. And so not only have they got to come up with what is this story, but the conceit is we're going to totally re-envision the line, create this new world from the ground up, and you're going to do that on your regular timetable on top of the deadlines you already have. So that had to be a tremendous challenge for guys who I feel like were pretty, again, creatively burnt out. But it seems like this just lit a fire under them. They rose to the occasion and created this world that felt very lived in from that first issue, right? That one shot of X-Men Alpha that introduces you to this landscape. It's a world that's really fully formed. It feels like it has a rich, natural history, even though we haven't been privy to this. You know they've thought it out. And the same kind of questions you have as a reader, the creators have considered and sort of...
Yeah, it's like being dropped into Star Wars for the first time in the original trilogy, you know? Like, there is a rich tapestry there, a backstory, a history that is just understood, and you don't have to explain it all, you know?
Yeah, and there are answers to the questions that you naturally have. Even though they might not be right in front of your face, there's an answer. It's been thought of, and it's sort of been provided for. The thing that kind of stands out in my mind about Age of Apocalypse, it's not so much that this happened because Professor X was killed 20 years in the past. I mean, that's a big part of it, sure, since that affects the formation of the X-Men. But had there been no X-Men, why does the world, turn to this horrible dystopia so quickly? It's not because the X-Men weren't around for it. It's because Apocalypse woke up prematurely while the X-Men are fighting Legion in the past, while Magneto is having this huge battle and unleashing, all of his energies over the city, fighting and trying to protect his friend, battling Legion. This is what wakes up Apocalypse 20 years before he should have. So he immediately gains the upper hand. And that's why things like the Fantastic Four split spaceflight doesn't happen. The Avengers never get a chance to assemble because Apocalypse just had enough of an edge that he has pretty much turned the world to shit before the superheroes can kind of come of age and gain an advantage. And that's sort of all it took was the balance of power shifting that very much. And that's something I think that gets lost in recollections of Age of Apocalypse was the element of Apocalypse himself, right? This is how it all came to be. It's not just that Xavier died when he shouldn't have.
Right.
And, you know, you mentioned all the great characters that came out of that, like Dark Beast, who is just a despicable, horrible, you know, everything that our Beast, Hank McCoy, is not. Just kind of this, like, Dr. Moreau character of unchecked privilege and power and what he can do with the resources at hand and how that corrupts a person. It's really quite shocking. They do the same thing almost with Havoc, where he's just a complete douchebag. Gosh, Nate Gray, remember him?
Oh my!
The Age of Apocalypse Cable, because you can't do an X-Men event without Cable. Comes over into makes his way into Earth 616 after all is said and done,
and is pushed to the moon.
Yes, his solo series. Wow, it went on for like 70-plus issues.
And who was reading it? That's what I want to know, because everybody I knew at my school hated him because we all resented how, like, Marvel was just sort of, and here's this new guy who's more powerful than any mutant who's ever lived.
Yeah.
Screw you if you disagree.
I was sort of suckered in at first, but around the time of, like, Onslaught, where he'd been around for just about a year, it was like, all right, that's enough. Nope, not going to have it anymore.
I've taken all I can take, and that's...
That's, you know, you fooled me once, yeah, so... But, and, you know, the creators on this, you had some early Warren Ellis work doing... He was writing Excalibur at the time, so when that flipped to... Well, it was still called Excalibur, but... spelled a little bit differently in the Age of Apocalypse version of that series. Doing some great work, like you said, with Ken Lashley. I always want to say Bobby Lashley when I...
Bastard.
Do we love Bobby?
Yes.
We love you, Bobby. One of the most underrated superhero writers of all time, guy by the name of John Francis Moore, no relation to Alan Moore, but he wrote Factor X, the
yes.
Age of Apocalypse X Factor. I don't know how to describe his writing.
Which, by the way, Factor X sounds like one of our comic book pitch titles we did.
Really, a lot of these do. Gambit and the Externals.
Yep. I'm not going to spoil it, but I do have a title that sounds almost exactly like Gambit and the Externals.
I will look forward to that. So, John Francis Moore on Factor X would go on to great acclaim on X-Force. Again, Steve Epting, who I mentioned previously on the Avengers. Joe Matarera, oh my gosh, not to all tastes. Yeah, right? So, but, I mean, for as long as Jim Lee had really defined the look of the X-Men throughout the better part of the 90s, you at last had someone come along and redefine it, for better or worse. And while I'm not a fan of the style that Joe Mad sort of pioneered and ushered in, I think that he did it the best of any of his imitators.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
You know, you had, like you said, the Kubert brothers, Steve Skros on X-Men with Jeff Loeb, which I think was some of his earliest published work as well. So all around, just really great creators. A story that hangs together a lot better than it should, considering how many cooks they had in the kitchen hit me at right the exactly the right age, just as you were saying, Greg, where I sort of knew what to expect with the X-Men line, how they would do an event every single year. But my mind was not prepared for something like this. I mean, it blew my adolescent mind.
When you were that age, were you like me, and did you think it was a permanent change?
I sort of wondered. I was, on the one hand, I was like, there's no way. There's just no way. But they were so committed to it that...
Yeah, once it got to, like, the two-month part, like, when it had been going on for, like, 2 months, I was like, I wonder if this is just the new, like, status quo.
Yeah. And I started to wonder, well, maybe it was going to be temporary, but now it's been 3 months, and I'm actually kind of digging it. So what if they just keep it going? I'd be okay with that. Maybe they will just keep it going, even if... they didn't plan to do that. That's where I first started to think about, I think, the inner workings, and that these things were designed by committee. They didn't just happen. You know what I mean? And started to pay attention to some of the names that I was seeing in the credits. So in a lot of ways, this was informative to me as a very young comic book reader. So that's why I've got to put it up there as my number one. And, you know, you saw vestiges of that play out in Secret War that Nick talked about. That was a line-wide version of Age of Apocalypse, essentially.
Right. Yeah, no, and it's appropriate that would be your number one because, again, as I mentioned earlier, it's kind of in some ways the quintessential X-Men event because it embraced the concept that it started with so thoroughly. In terms of the X-Men have always had these kind of time travel, alternate dimension, alternate world stories, and this was the ultimate exploration of that. And I think that's why, one of the reasons why it holds up over time and people keep revisiting it over the years is because it's kind of a glimpse of a ballsy story that probably wouldn't be done today to the degree that it was.
Yeah, absolutely. It is an alternate universe take on our Merry Mutants, but... sometimes that's what you need to kind of reinforce and validate what was there all along.
Right.
Because after enough time, I mean, this was a good 30-plus years into publication history for the X-Men, you begin to take for granted what you love about this franchise and what their themes are and why it's so important and why it's so popular as well. So you kind of take those things away and put a new spin on it to remind people, oh, okay, yep, these themes are really universal.
And it's a palate cleanser in the same way that the two kind of preeminent DC crossovers of the 90s, Nightfall and the Death of Superman, were the same way in that They took the main players off the board to remind you why they were on the board in the first place and why you liked them and why you didn't want them to be different than they were. You know what I mean? So
exactly.
Very successful story. Well, with that, ladies and gentlemen, we come to the end of our countdown. It's another successful edition. And what we usually do here is we get everybody to quickly run through their 5 through 1. Nick, what was your 5 through 1?
All right, at number 5, I had Ultimate Comics Doomsday. At number 4, I had Civil War. At 3, I had Secret Wars 2015. At 2, I had Ultimate 6. And at number 1, I had The Infinity Gauntlet.
And at number 5, I had Executioner's Song. At number 4, I had Extinction Agenda. At number 3, I had Age of Apocalypse. At number two, I had Fatal Attractions, and at number one, I had The Infinity Gauntlet. Tim?
Man, after my own heart, Greg. I had at number five, Operation Galactic Storm. Number four, The Infinity Gauntlet. Number three, Executioner Song. Number two, Inferno. And number one, Age of Apocalypse.
Very good. And so we hope that everybody out there in Place to Be Nation Popland enjoyed this countdown. It's entertaining, informative, as always, when Tim's on. He has a lot of backstory to these events that always provides new info for me, I know. So hopefully all of you out there have enjoyed. And send us your lists. Get on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page and please contribute. Let us know what your lists are. Tell us what we got right, what we got wrong. Make fun of us for having all these 90s stories. Do whatever it is that you feel necessary to do. But we do look forward to hearing from you on that. Tim, you can catch on Twitter at Cyke, C-Y-K-E 68. Is that correct, sir?
That's right, appropriately enough.
Absolutely. And anything else you want to shill while you're on our show?
Not just yet, but maybe soon.
Keep an eye out for the Timster. Nick, tell the good folks out there what they got coming their way here in the near future.
All right, from us, next week we'll be back with an edition of Off the Page, in which we'll be looking at the recent animated adaptation of Batman the Killing Joke.
Ooh.
That one's been controversial for a lot of people, so we're going to be taking a look at it.
Somewhat unique.
Yeah, Greg's seen it. I haven't actually watched it yet, so that's going to be interesting to get our thoughts on that one. In 2 weeks' time, we've got our debut edition of Hard Travelers for Hire, where we're going to be revisiting 2008's Iron Man. And then coming up later in September, we've got a long book hunt. And the current plan is for us to take a look at Kevin Smith and Joe Quesada's Guardian Devil, their run on Daredevil. And then finally, the next time we join you for Countdown, we will be once again delving into the world of Marvel, this time with special guest Ben Morse helping us count down the top five Marvel video games of all time.
Yes, we're going against type here for the next few countdowns as we're going all Marvel. So be on the lookout for that, ladies and gentlemen. And we want to thank Tim for coming on. I always appreciate it, dude. Always a fun time talking anything with you, pretty much. So thanks.
Well, I want to thank you fellas for having me.
Absolutely.
Anytime.
And we'll have you on again in the future, of course. And for the illustrious Nick Duke, I am Greg Phillips. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are, again, still in mourning for the elimination of Ho-Ho Loon. So we will do our best to recover and have a more upbeat first half of the episode next week.
It's what Ho-Ho Loon would want.
TJ Perkins is still in it, right?
He is. Technical Lightning, as they used to unfortunately call him in ROH. He is still alive in the
as of this recording, he is still in.
Yes. He's still in, damn it. And the Noam Dar better not beat him, I can tell you that. Noam.
I don't care what they call TJP, he got me shook.
I like him. I like him. He's lit, ladies and gentlemen. And with that said, please tune in next week. We appreciate your time, and go read comics, go buy comics, support the industry, support the creators. Have a good one.
Glorious. No, I won't give in. I won't give in till I'm victorious.